mí me gusta a mí a la mañana, después del café me río, que pasearme por La Habana, que con mi cigarro encendido. Pasearme por La Habana con mi cigarro encendido, que te recordaremos aunque me cueste morir. Te recordaremos aunque me cueste morir, que te recordaremos aunque me cueste morir, que te recordaremos aunque me cueste.
Diego El Cigala with El Raton. That about does it for Radio Free Chico. We're going to hand it off to Robert Jones and Peace and Social Justice. I'll see you again next week. Thanks for tuning in. Bye-bye.
And Social Justice Program for Friday, September 24th, 2021. I'm your host, Robert Jones. I'm here, joined in the studio by my compadre and colleague, Patrick Newman. Patrick Newman is the founder of Chico Friends on the Street. It's not an overstatement to say that he pretty much has his finger on the pulse of the homeless crisis here in Chico. He's been doing this work for at least 8 years now, more than that, Pat, I'm sure. But if you listen to this program, Patrick Newman is no stranger to you or these airwaves. And we have a lot to talk about because there's a lot going on in the city with regard to the homeless crisis and the crisis in general of just the hate on poverty. But Patrick Newman.
Be here, Robert. Thank you very much for having me on again.
Sure. Well, thanks for making it in here. Well, there's a number of things I want to talk about, and for those people who are not familiar with some of these stories, Pat, the first thing I wanted to talk about was, and if you can give us a little background and a little bit of an update, because with regard to the killing, the shooting, the two folks who were shot, one died, Guy Van Zandt, and there is a suspect in custody. So anyway, Pat, can you go back for those who don't know what happened? Just a little bit of a recap and like what the update is on the murder and also attempted murder of two unhoused folk.
Well, that's not a story that I'm especially familiar with, other than, you know, news articles and talking to a few people on the streets. But it looks like a number of young men, or I guess boys, showed up over at Tykert Ponds, and the number has been described as two and sometimes three and sometimes four, and high school age. Ultimately, the shooter, who was arrested in the last couple of days, is 16 years old. The district attorney is saying that it sounds like there's not going to be, at least as of now, any charges against the boys that were with him, but only the shooter. So there's a lot more to be revealed about that. But what happened was they came late at night, 2 or 3 in the morning. There was some exchanges, and according to people who were in the camp, some hate speech sort of talk, just calling people out as tweakers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then one of the boys shot into the camp, killed Guy Van Sant, and wounded another man who is in the hospital. There doesn't seem to be a lot of information about what condition he's in. But, of course, there's a lot of questions that come forward when you start thinking about an incident like that. What kind of community response have we seen? What does it mean in the context of violence against the poorest people as a subject area? And there's a lot to unpack there.
Patrick, you did mention hate speech. Neither of us is an attorney, but I'm just curious. There's clear cases of hate speech, that racial hate speech and things like that. But with regard to hate brought upon the most poor, the poverty stricken, is that, so calling someone a tweaker or calling someone, you know, a homeless, is that, do you know by any chance, where does that fall with regard to hate speech?
I don't know. I think I've just sort of grabbed that because of what I think of as an obvious parallel. In terms of, like, technically, what does that mean? I don't know. I just think of homeless people and people especially, well, who are destitute and in the public space as being a class of people. That's something that I take as sort of an article of faith or a principle or something. As a class of people, these people are exposed to all kinds of verbal harassment, and I hear it when I'm on the plaza. On, you know, when we're there on Sunday, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, people will drive by and scream out stuff. And so it's just a whole bunch of insults that are meant to, it's a way people express their rage and against this class of people who are really, they're very identifiable, as I think any other class or identity group would be, simply because of their appearance and where they are and their body language. And, you know, you got somebody out there pushing a cart and they're wearing rags, and they obviously look, you know, like they haven't had access to a shower. I mean, this is an identifiable class of people. So if somebody wants to drive by and wants to can identify them, has this kind of bigotry against this class of people, and has a whole bunch of different things they can say in that circumstance to insult them, that seems to me to be a form of hate speech. But I guess, you know, that's an interesting question as to exactly what we mean by that. So I'm probably using it loosely.
I'm in conversation with Patrick Newman, who is the founder of Chico Friends on the Street. As you mentioned in passing, Patrick, every Sunday at noon, you can be found at the plaza. And also, Chico Friends on the Street is now involved with a Monday, Wednesday, Friday morning, 9 a.m. breakfast, handing out breakfast there. So you've been basically on the street, as the name of the organization, Chico Friends on the Street. You've been on the street with the unhoused for many years now. And going back to the issue you raised as a class, I mean, I think it's safe to say that, you know, this class is the poorest, the most poverty-stricken, as well as other issues with regard to addiction and cognitive disabilities. And, yeah, it's pretty clear that if I were to drive by and make a racial slur or a slur about gender or trans, that would be clearly a case of hate speech, and rightly so, as it should be. But it is interesting that this class of the poorest of our fellow citizens, it's kind of like there's almost like equal opportunity revulsion among all strata, you know, anyone who's not in that class, and anyone on the left or the right. I mean, it's sort of like it's the class of people that it's okay to feel repugnance to one out of your neighborhood. Can you speak to that?
Well, one way I would approach that is to think of it as the class of people for whom their suffering means the least to us. In other words, they are so othered in our discourse, including on the left. It's difficult to get uptake on the left on this, frankly, after years of trying. When it comes to the suffering of that, if you want to call that an identity group, the suffering of that identity group is really hard to hear. And this kind of leads me into a whole bunch of thinking about hierarchy and how that works and how we think about who we have license to ignore, which I've, you know, in conversations with you, Robert, I've also related to these animal rights subjects that have to do with whether or not another being, another sentient being, is worthy of the kind of attention, imagination, empathy, whatever we bring to really hearing them, really hearing their suffering and taking it in and looking for the information in that suffering. So, yeah, this class of people, I think, is so far down the hierarchy that it's like as you go down that hierarchy, there's the voice of suffering is exponentially less hearable, sorry for lack of a better word. So that's definitely part of, you know, trying to understand the culture around how we deal with that kind of that particular type of poverty.
Circling back to your mentioning the response to the Guy Van Sant shooting, you did lay out for us pretty clearly, you know, just the facts, as they used to say on Dragnet. But now let's talk a little bit about circling back to this class and the response of the community, and I mean all of the community, to the murder and the other shooting.
There was a response, and perhaps I'm overly subjective in this respect, and I have some kind of bias or something. It's hard to measure these things. But in terms of how I would think a community would respond to the shooting of any other, a random shooting of any other group of people, I think the response in Chico was very minimal and very superficial, frankly. I mean, people talked about it. There was a little vigil. There was a couple of splattering of letters to the editor sort of thing. But like I said in a letter to the editor that I wrote, if a shooter had gone by a schoolyard and shot into a schoolyard and killed a child and wounded another, thousands of people would be mobilized by that. And I won't go through every other identity group, but I think we could say that there's a significant difference in how that would have been greeted. That kind of an incident would have been greeted with any other identity group because of the value that we assign to the people that are on the streets. And frankly, it's a very low value. And I'm sorry to say it, but the very fact that we have 500,000 people in America plus without shelter tells us on its face, you know, how we respond to the poorest and most vulnerable people in our society. So it makes sense that it would follow from that when an incident like this occurs in a culture like ours, that there wouldn't be the kind of public outcry and outrage and commitment to change that we would expect with any other group. I mean, of course, it's, you know, you're comparing failures of all kinds here with respect to the oppression of different groups of people. And so, I mean, I don't know. The only purpose in doing that, it seems like to me, is to look at this one class and to try to look at what we can learn about ourselves from how we respond to that class. One other part to this, which is, I think, really important, is that to keep saying, look, this kind of violence is overt. And when someone gets shot like this, that's very tangible to people. However, when we talk about violence, we have a culture of violence, which is something I've said many times, toward the poorest people. And I relate this to everything from closing our only soup kitchen to not supplying people with 24-hour toilet access to constantly rousting people to criminalizing every aspect of their lives. The people on the streets live with daily violence to depriving them, other than the soup kitchen, just depriving them of things like sleeping bags and raincoats and all the things that we could easily, given our the size of our economy, supply people. So in once we failed to house people, which is the first failure, then there's another failure that comes with a human rights failure on the streets. And so that this is an important subject, because I think a lot of people who do care will sort of crystallize or gather around a moment like this and say, wow, that's terrible that someone was shot. But they won't show up when the kind of violence that's being done in depriving people of 24-hour toilet access comes up. You might get one or two people to show up for that. But it's violence. It's violence against people. Deprivation is a form of violence. What we talked about earlier with demonization, hate speech is a form of violence. Criminalization is a form of violence. And ultimately taking people's freedom arbitrarily and forcing them into containment facilities, which is really what the right wants to do, that's another form of violence. So this should be seen a little more broadly.
I'm speaking with Patrick Newman of Chico Friends on the Street, a homeless and human rights advocacy organization here in Chico. And Patrick, just to clarify, when you said closing the only soup kitchen, we're talking about the Jesus Center, which was closed. So that's gone. And would you agree with me? I mean, I'm that seems to be a form of violence. It's in the deprivation category, and intentionally depriving the poorest, the most needy, of really, basically, we're just talking about sustenance. The Peace and Social Justice Program is made possible by the generous contributions of KZF supporters and by Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op, open every day on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico. Peace and Social Justice is also made possible by Chico Performances, presenting 7 Things I've Learned with Ivor Glass, host and creator of This American Life, on Saturday, September 25th at Laxon Auditorium. Ira Glass and his This American Life have won the highest honors for broadcasting and journalistic excellence, including 7 Peabody Awards and the first Pulitzer Prize ever awarded for audio journalism. Tickets at the University Box Office, 898-6333, or at chicoperformances.com. So thank you to Chico Performances and Chico Natural Foods for supporting community radio, and in particular, this program, Peace and Social Justice. So I'm in conversation with Patrick Newman, Chico Friends on the Street founder and advocate for human rights here in the city and for the unhoused. Well, Pat, connecting this idea of demonization, of reifying into a class, a demonized class, the unhoused, the poorest, the most poverty-stricken. I was wondering if you wanted with me to turn to a recent controversy when one of our city council members, former mayor, Sean Morgan. Sean Morgan was interviewed on a recent radio program here in town, and he made some remarks that caused the courts to respond. But before we go into any detail of that, Pat, can you give us a little bit of a context about the injunction and exactly what that did, and then how it was that this particular appearance on a talk radio show by Sean Morgan was a breach of confidentiality? Can you set up the story for listeners who are unfamiliar with the injunction and the latest developments there?
Sure. So last spring, previous one day to the last sweep that the police were going to do in the Comanche Creek area, a large homeless camp, a temporary restraining order came through the Eastern District Court from Judge England, restraining the city against essentially moving people. To simplify it, to put a restraining order on the city, prohibiting them from moving people and sweeping camps. Okay, so that preliminary restraining order was in place until about 2 months ago, when a preliminary injunction. Sorry, temporary restraining order. Did I say that? Sorry.
I think you were saying but so.
Yeah, temporary restraining order,
so
TRO.
Last spring.
The TRO was put in place last spring, prohibiting the city of Chico from continuing to sweep camps. And that happened the day before the last camp was swept. Later, a couple months later, that became a preliminary injunction. That preliminary injunction puts in place a prohibition on the city sweeping or moving people. So that, as of today, people on the streets are able to essentially camp in our public spaces without being moved along. And so they essentially have a right to rest as things stand today.
Well, in fact, can I interrupt for just a moment?
Yeah.
So this injunction, the temporary restraining order, and the injunction by Judge England, I believe, who is a Bush appointee, this is in response to Legal Services of Northern California's being the plaintiffs representing 8 unhoused folks against the city of Chico, right? So, and the reason I want to put this in context is because Sean Morgan, he responds to these, he talks about the 8 plaintiffs holding the city hostage. So I want the listeners to get the picture that there was a suit brought against the city of Chico for being in violation of law, a shelter law. I think it's Boise was the ruling, earlier ruling. And Pat, you followed this for so long. In fact, you, if I remember correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong, years ago you sought some kind of legal remedy for what the city was doing to the unhoused population. So you were sort of on the leading edge of that. And then finally, in 2021, we get a temporary restraining order, and on behalf of Legal Services of the 8 plaintiffs. And then, as you mentioned, the injunction goes into effect a few months later, which basically says you cannot, because of the shelter situation in Chico, you can't arrest people or charge them with misdemeanors or criminal offenses for being unhoused. Because, as we've talked about many times, and for those folks who don't know, there are many laws that have been instituted criminalizing homelessness. It's basically acrimony against homeless folk, and the motivation for these laws, I mean, on the books, it looks like it's a safety situation, and it's about keeping the businesses clear of homeless. But really, we really know what it's really a hatred thing. And that reminds me, Pat, and I do want to get to you, you're continuing to lay this out for us, but circling back to the safety issue, I think just touching back on the Guy Van Zandt situation, you know, that one of the hue and cry we hear from many citizens is, I'm afraid of the homeless, they scare me, I'm afraid. And speaking factually and statistically, what is true is that the homeless population, the poorest population, are actually at the highest risk of crime. We're talking violent crime, we're talking assault, we're talking robbery, burglary. So that's an interesting, that's a whole other thing. So we have this Guy Van Zandt who is shot, and another guy is shot. And, you know, that's an issue that we should maybe explore a little bit too, about the precarity, if you will, of being living on the streets, and the danger for, you know, for men and women, and there's different dangers for each gender. It's very precarious. So I think that's something we could maybe circle back to. I just didn't want to mention that. But yeah, so now I'm sorry for the digression, but yeah, if you can continue with laying out how we get to Sean Morgan's, I would call them at best insensitive comments, but please continue, Patrick Newman.
Yeah, so homeless people die 20 years younger than the rest of us, and it's because of ongoing violence that occurs as people try to live on the streets. So, yeah, I mean, I agree with you on all that. What motivated me in 2015, what you alluded to a minute ago with Legal Services and also the ACLU, was a whole raft of homeless criminalization laws that passed in 2015 called the Offenses Against Public Property Ordinance. That was a big watershed in Chico. And when that passed, it was pretty clear that there were storage laws and all kinds of other laws in there that looked unconstitutional to me as someone who's not an expert, but I went around fishing to see if we could get some litigation against that. Well, it really took COVID and then shelter in place and then the sweeps to really generate some real pushback against what the city of Chico's been doing.
And then maybe, so there was really, and maybe even the Paradise Fire, perhaps?
I mean, well, that, yeah, it's all part of a fabric, but, you know, in terms of stresses on the community and everything, mm-hmm. yeah, it's a complicated web of stuff. But what Judge England said was really kind of a two-pronged thing. He said, look, your criminalization laws are not constitutional. Flatly said so, used the word unconstitutional. And he also said, look, you don't have enough shelter in Chico to be enforcing these camping ordinances. You failed to provide enough shelter to legitimately be within Martin v. Boise, which is the case that you alluded, that you mentioned earlier, too. So now we have Bobby Warren versus City of Chico, and that is, you know, being brilliantly argued by Legal Services in Northern California, and I'm so grateful for that. But what we have is a negotiation process that's going on. It's all in a black box, and it's the court has been very clear that no one who's involved in the negotiation in Warren versus Chico is allowed to talk about it, and so in public. So what's that negotiation? Well, it's all about what the city of Chico is going to do to address the injunction that's now in place and what has to be done in order for the city of Chico to begin a process of lifting that injunction. And the city of Chico has to do something about its sheltering policies because they're totally inadequate. They tried to do this ruse at the airport. The judge saw right through it. It was just a 500 spaces marked out on a tarmac. The city tried to take that to the judge and say, look, we did it. Well, the judge said, no, that's not a humane approach. It obviously wasn't. And then, so we've defaulted back to, there's a lot of people at Comanche Creek still. There's people at Tigard Ponds, which we mentioned earlier. And then there's the whole question of what are we going to do about our statutes? And so there's been some little tweaks offered, totally inadequate changes to our laws. I think that's going to be something the court's going to keep looking at. But in the midst of all this, we have Mr. Morgan's comments, which were made on KPay early in the morning a couple weeks ago, where he, who is party to all of this, because he's a city council member, he has access to that negotiation, has been admonished by the court not to speak about it, and he did. So the court, the new magistrate judge, Judge Newman.
No relation to you.
Ben. No relation to me, but he
made you. He made you proud of the other Newman.
Yeah, the other Newman clan. So he made, you know, he issued an order to show cause why Sean Morgan and the city of Chico should not be fined for the breach of confidentiality that was obvious in the KPay interview, which you just listened to. You want to describe what you heard there?
Well, I'll do better than that. I can describe my experience of listening to it, which was, it was one of the hardest 15 minutes to have to get through, to hear the prevarication of Sean Morgan, the exaggerations, the demonizing. But I did, for the sake of our program, soldier on and listen to the full 15-minute interview. Good thing I hadn't eaten breakfast because it may have come up, but I did, Patrick, I have some clips from that program, which, you know, I don't listen to, but in listening to this one episode, it's, you know, it's a boilerplate kind of, you know, right wing hate radio kind of thing. So Morgan goes on, and so what I did, I had some clips. What I'm wondering if we can do, Pat, I want to play a few clips and just get your response to, you know, your reflections on what you're hearing and sort of deconstruct, if you will, what we're hearing and the role that what Morgan, the narrative that we're hearing in this interview, the function that it's playing in this concerted effort to demonize and criminalize and compartmentalize. So why don't we do that? What do you say we play a couple of these clips and then we can do a little debriefing on it?
Sure, let's hear what Mr. Morgan has to say.
So our first clip is very provocative, and it's intended to be provocative. And he, you know, what I want you to listen to in this clip is that Sean Morgan, basically, he calls out the homeless, or as he calls them, the vagrant community, for being terrorists, which post 9/11, I can't think of a worse moniker, a worse descriptor to be called than, I mean, terrorist is pretty big, right? So that's a charge language. It's intentionally charged. And so he does so. It's interesting. He calls the unhoused folk terrorists, and it's kind of like he asks a kind of rhetorical, you know, like a Socratic question, and it's supposed to be this big ha-ha moment. But so let's listen to what we have our former mayor and current city council member Sean Morgan spewing on a local talk radio show. Let's listen to that.
What is adequate? Well, we're not going to tell you what adequate is. We're not going to define shelter for you. So you want us to come up with shelter for X amount of people, but no one will define shelter. Yes. Well, how will we know when we get there? We'll tell you. Oh, my. Okay, so what do you call somebody? I'm asking you, Mbaka. Mm-hmm. What do you call someone that takes hostages?
You want to say it? I'll say it. Terrorist.
I'm just asking. All right.
Patrick Newman, before we continue, I need to let our listeners know that you are listening to KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. The program is the Peace and Social Justice Program. I am your host, Robert Jones. Today I have in the studio with me Mr. Patrick Newman, homeless and human rights advocate here in Chico, Chico Friends on the Street. You can always check them out at chicofriendsonthestreet.org. Okay, so Patrick, we heard something going on there. Sean Morgan asking the hosts, talking about the notion of shelter, which I want to expand on. So I do want to talk about this notion of shelter, and I actually want to read from the injunction with regard to shelter. But I'm going to throw it over to you. General reflections. What did you hear in there? What was being communicated to the community?
Well, I can see that there's some ambiguity around the question of what we mean by shelter, beds. There's all these things. Okay, sure. But we also know that it's disingenuous to not admit that there are shelter potentials available to Chico. Like, what about a tiny house village, which has never been well supported by the city? That's an understatement. I think it's been obstructed by the city. Mr. Morgan knows that tiny house villages work, that they're humane, that they can house people inexpensively and far more effectively than what we would expect to see on our streets. It's a step up. Everybody knows that. And everybody knows that if you put together a combination of a sanctioned camp and some safe parking and some tiny house villages and some well-run, non-coercive kinds of congregate shelters, that you can put together a cluster of different solutions and you can begin to bring a whole bunch of different approaches. What the city of Chico has done is, and Sean Morgan has been very clear about this in the past, his interest, and he said this over and over again, is in trying to eliminate services in Chico as much as possible so that homeless people will go somewhere else. I'm not making this up. This is something he said publicly several times. On one occasion, he even said that if we eliminate services, we can get the homeless to all go to Oroville, which he called a third world country. So we know where he's coming from. He's been very consistent, and in some begrudging way, I have to respect him for that because he keeps saying it. And the fact of the matter is, what he said on KPAY is consistent with that. Well, let's pretend we don't know what shelter means. Let's pretend we're being persecuted, and thereby we can, you know, keep this ruse going that we don't know what he means by shelter. Of course we know. As far as the terrorism thing goes, it's, as you said earlier the other day, it's classic scapegoating. It's like you take a class of people and you make them, though they are the most oppressed people, the most powerful. So they're holding me hostage. So he's got, you know, Bobby Warren and these other seven people, and he even says, with a gun to our head. Well, wow. I mean, knowing people on the streets for years, to think that all, you know, the citizens of Chico with, you know, Canyon Oaks and their 401k programs and their police force and their lavish lifestyles by world standards, that we're the victims, and the people who are pushing a cart and have nothing but a tarp are holding us hostage. It's quite a stretch, but it makes for, you know, interesting. It makes for an interesting rhetorical device that I guess, you know, can be effective with people who want to think of it this way. In other words, once you commit to being willing to scapegoat and demonize a population, then any device you use, and we see this historically, works, because those black people are a threat to our white women, or, you know, the Jews, or, you know, whatever. So this is not unprecedented in history. No matter how far you beat the American Indian down, and destroy and steal their land and destroy the environment around them, somehow they're still a threat until the last one's dead. I mean, these are not new things. And I said last night at the council meeting, I don't think history is going to treat us very kindly when it comes to all this.
So, yes, I mean, Pat, there is a history of this, right? This is a technique with regard to the label terrorist. So we have the homeless, the eight plaintiffs representing the homeless as a class community here in the city. They are they're the terrorists, and they have a gun to the city's heads. And so, yeah, this is a classic, as you point out, classic authoritarian neo-fascist technique is to label the most oppressed, the most vulnerable, the most precarious amongst us as the aggressors, right? The danger, right? So this is done. Now, I want to touch on this thing about that Sean Morgan is telling us that no one knows what shelter means, and the courts aren't telling us what shelter means, and poor boo-hoo, we don't know what shelter means, and we have this place out at the airport, but that's not good enough. Every time we come up with a shelter, they tell us we don't know. You don't know. Okay, so let me tell you what it says in the injunction. In fact, let me read what it says in the injunction. It says, I'm quoting from the injunction from Judge England regarding the shelter issue. Right. So he says here, the court extended the TRO, which is the
temporary
restraining order, after that initial hearing, allowed the parties. Okay. According to the city, the city then, quote, constructed an outdoor temporary shelter facility at the Chico Municipal Airport that accommodates all 571 city's homeless persons. This raises the question, what is shelter? Now, this is a judge who is an esteemed judge who was appointed by Bush. Let me read what it says. According to defendants, quote, shelter is a practically available space for persons who are unhoused to go on a given day that would enable a city to enforce its anti-camping, sit-lie, and so forth ordinances. Now, when it says according to the defendants, that's the definition that the city is providing for a shelter. Let me repeat that. A practically available space for persons who are unhoused to go on a given day that would enable a city to enforce its anti-camping, sit-lie, and so forth ordinances, right? So, Pat, I mean, I'm not in the Twilight Zone, am I, when I say that basically they're defining a shelter as that facility which allows us to harass, to rouse, to arrest. Any facility that allows us to harass and arrest the homeless, that's a shelter. Am I reading that correctly?
Yes, and this is the problem with Martin v. Boise, is that people think it's some kind of silver bullet or panacea or something. It's not. All it does is say, if there's a shelter bed somewhere, with some qualifiers, but not a lot, you can arrest someone for camping. That's what Martin v. Boise says. So Martin v. Boise does not give homeless people a whole lot of protection from either being arrested because they don't want to go into a facility that doesn't meet their needs, or protection from being coerced into going into a facility that does not meet their needs. So imagine the worst possible congregate shelter situation, one that none of us would want to be in, and then imagine how a city could use that to enforce under Martin v. Boise. Well, that's the law as of today. So there's a way that we could set up probably a large indoor congregate Joe Arpaio style tent city with beds in it and some air conditioning, and have those beds out there on the tarmac, and that might have qualified, frankly, as shelter. This is where it gets tricky, because you can't rely on the law in this case. The law is woefully behind what I think of as sort of the moral cutting edge of this issue, which is to go, look, it's not just a matter of a bunk bed somewhere in some kind of containment facility. It's a matter of how do we address the suffering of suffering people? And is that the best way that we can do it as a community? And the answer is, of course not. Is that a way that people on the right will want to do it? Yes, because it's cheap, and that's the Marbut model, which is basically like the Robert Marbut model, which is use coercion and any kind of deprivation and coercion and in some cases criminalization to push people into containment. So we're not in safe waters just because we do something that is inside the law. What I think happened with the city of Chico is they didn't play this very well, because just marking a bunch of spaces on an asphalt tarmac next to the airport and putting a couple porta potties out there, that's pretty insulting to a judge. That's like saying, screw you, we're not even going to do the minimum under Martin v. Boise. It's interesting how unsophisticated that approach was.
Well, Pat, on that note, let me continue with what Judge England wrote. He says, we turn to the dictionary. Merriam-Webster defines shelter as something that covers or affords protection, an establishment providing food and shelter as to the homeless, an establishment that houses and feeds stray or unwanted animals, a position or the state of being covered and protected. In the Cambridge English Dictionary, I'm quoting again from Judge England, in the Cambridge English Dictionary, shelter is a building, quote, a building designed to give protection from bad weather, danger, or attack. And Black's Law Dictionary defines shelter as, quote, a place of refuge providing safety from danger, attack, or observation. Even Martin v. Boise, which does not directly answer this question, seems to contemplate shelter will offer individuals a place to sleep indoors. And now this is the part I want to emphasize. Under none of these definitions is the airport site a, quote, shelter. It is an asphalt tarmac with no roof and no walls, no water and no electricity. It is an open space with what amounts to a large umbrella for some shade. It affords no real cover or protection to anyone. That ends the court's current inquiry. Okay. Now, with that in mind, given that context, Pat, let's listen to another excerpt from the interview where I want to put a spotlight on this issue of shelter, but also I want you to comment on Sean Morgan's breach of the confidentiality in this segment and tell us what the hell's going on, why this was a big deal.
Getting a closed session. This is Tuesday night. Normally you can't talk about this. We agreed we would. There's a press release coming out. This is what the city's doing. Because the judge, neither the magistrate judge nor the federal judge, I'm not criticizing them, they won't define shelter. Everything the city's come up with, including, hey, how about this airport thing? We're spending $35,000 a month. The plaintiff says no. Not only no, they added more things to the list that they wanted. We're like, holy moly, how are we supposed to do this? That's not a fair negotiation. So he said, okay, wait a minute. We're working on this BMX site. We don't really like it, but we could put pallet shelters. There's some things we could do with the service providers. The county came in. They said, hey, we'll help you with that with money and some other stuff. We realize the situation you're in. That could take up to a year. Well, there won't be a city left for a year. So then we go to the plaintiffs. We say, hey, how about this? How about if we let you stay in Comanche Creek? Okay, we know we don't like you there, but we'll take the resources from the airport. We'll put them out at Comanche to clean it up, protect the business owners, put up some fencing, porta potties, the dumpsters, all that stuff. We'll let you have that while we build the other site. You know what they say? They don't budge an inch. They ask for more stuff on the other side. This is not a negotiation. This is a hostage situation. That's what it is. People are going to be just unreal upset that I'm saying this thing. There's no question that's what it is.
So, Patrick Newman, can you respond to that? Was just for those listeners just tuning in. That was an interview recorded on a local talk radio station of Sean Morgan, and he was eventually, after this broadcast, he was reprimanded by the court for breach of confidentiality with regard to negotiations between the eight plaintiffs as represented by legal services in Northern California and the city of Chico. And so now there's Sean Morgan's, breach. Pat, what are we listening to there?
Well, first of all, he says that he doesn't want to say anything against the judge, but he does in that interview say that the judge is on their side. I mean, that's a quote. So I'm not sure how Judge England will take that. I'm glad that he's going to hear this because I think it gives some insight into where we're at with all this. But when you say the judge is on their side, that's kind of suggesting that there isn't an objective of ear, and that the process is loaded. It's pretty provocative stuff, but. As far as what's being the breach that's happening there is that inside this black box, they're having these conversations about Comanche Creek and the airport and the area behind Torres where there's 4 acres where we should have had a tiny house village in place like years ago. But the city has obstructed all such projects. So the breach there is taking what's happening in the negotiation over how this is all going to be done, and then That's a breach of the technical requirement not to talk about that negotiation. But there's another breach here, which is kind of interesting, and that's to take something that you have knowledge of because you have an inside seat, and then to describe it in absolutely biased, subjective terms so that you're the only one who's seeing it, and then you can literally say, as he does, that they're demanding that they put up a Ferris wheel for the homeless or whatever. So there's something very, let's just say, unfair and dishonest in that because, and I can see why the court was upset, because when you're in a position of power and you can take inside knowledge and spin it in your direction, you're taking advantage of a situation in a way that's really unfair. So I don't know if that's a good answer to your question, but what's happening with the Comanche Creek thing is, look, you know, the city's scrambling now because now we have this breach and we can talk about what's going on inside there because he's telling us. They're in this quagmire of like, well, we're flat-footed. We haven't done our work, you know. One of our homeless coordinators told me that Chico is the only city where solutions of this sort are seen as being off the table that she's worked in, and that's kind of the city culture. And so now, with this is not something we're good at. This is not something we're enthusiastic about. There's no passion for it. So it's like a child who's being expected to clean their room but doesn't want to do it, and so they're dragging their feet, and it's a mess, and they don't know how to do it because they haven't, you know, or whatever. That's what's going on. It's a lot of foot dragging, and it's a lot of unwillingness to take a good faith approach to it. And so, of course, nothing works. Everything you do is, you know, kind of a mess. And so this thing with the airport, now Comanche, I mean, he's not really telling us anything but what he wants us to hear, which is those other guys aren't negotiating in good faith, and we're trying hard because we're looking at Comanche and we're looking at, you know, the acres behind Torres. But there, if this was being done in good faith, the city would have a much more coherent and effective response to all this.
I'm speaking with Patrick Newman of Chico Friends on the Street. You're tuned into the Peace and Social Justice Program. Pat, I want to circle back to some other clips of Sean Morgan on his radio soapbox. Before I do that, I need to let you know that Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Paradise Community Guilds, fostering community by nurturing creativity, practicing stewardship of nature, and promoting values of sustainability. Paradise Community Guilds invites all people of goodwill and community spirit to help carry out that intent. To get involved, visit ParadiseGuilds.org or visit them on Facebook and give them a call. You could over at 762-1490. That's 762-1490 for Paradise Community Guilds. Peace and Social Justice is also made possible by CNA Cleaning, serving Chico, Paradise, Durham, and Oroville since 1989. Bonded and insured, C&A Cleaning offers regular and one-time residential and commercial cleaning services using environmentally friendly cleaning products. C&A Cleaning also offers ultrasonic blind cleaning. For more information or for employment opportunities, call C&A Cleaning at 514-7738. Well, thank you to C&A Cleaning and to Paradise Community Guilds for supporting the Peace and Social Justice program, heard on these very airwaves every Friday from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Today, we're focusing on the latest in the escalating homeless crisis here in Chico. I have with me in the studio the person who I think is the most informed, has his finger on the pulse of the Chico homeless crisis, is Patrick Newman, the founder of Chico Friends on the Street. Pat, I want to circle back now. I want to listen to another segment. I want to finish this. We have other things to talk about, and I don't want to give Sean Morgan any more undue time on the radio than I think he deserves, which is probably zero. But let me carry on. Let's hear it. One more. I have two more clips. Another clip. This clip is going to focus on, and this dovetails in exactly what you were just talking about, Pat. This is Sean Morgan's interpretation, his spin on what the plaintiffs are requesting from the city. Let's hear how he spins this.
The plaintiffs want AC. They want heat. Not everybody in town has AC. People that do have homes, they want hot plates. They want a shower a day. They want places for their dogs. They want laundry services. I'm not making any of this up. I'm not exaggerating even a little bit. And in the meantime, until they get that, they keep telling people, come to Chico, come to Chico, come to Chico. Every city in California is now saying, hey, go to Chico. They can't do anything to you. The business owners, the homes around Comanche Creek, the people downstream of Comanche Creek, everybody's suffering because 8 people are being completely unreasonable and will not negotiate in good faith.
So, Patrick Newman, now we've heard our third clip of Sean Morgan. I do need to let the listeners know that if you enjoy this program, you can now tip the show, tip the program at KZFR.org, and we love you for it. Thanks for listening. So, Patrick, let's go back to reactions. Sean Morgan, the unreasonable demands. They want daily laundry service, air conditioning. I don't know. So, anyway, give me your take on all this.
Well, fundamentally, there's a difference in terms of opinion on whether or not we have a housing crisis or not, and I hate to broaden it that much all of a sudden, but it's worth remembering that we're talking about people who are really in denial that there is such a thing as a housing crisis. So if you go to Ed Mayer, you know, the housing authority director in Chico, and you ask him, you know, how many affordable housing units do we need in this county, and he'll tell you 5,000 to 6,000, that we're that far behind. This is a national problem, especially on the West Coast. So When you remain in denial of that fundamental housing injustice, that fundamental housing deprivation issue, then it's very hard to get over to air conditioning and washing clothes and having a shower every day, because somehow you think that magically these people are going to go away, or I don't know what else happens. But if you're talking about looking at the fact that these people don't have shelter, and you're talking about what happens with shelter in most places in the world, you have habitable shelter. Well, what does that mean? Well, you can't be out on a tarmac in a little tent at 115 degrees without dying. I know this from personal experience when I was in Death Valley one time. It gets very hot there. But anyway, point being, if you're talking about these fundamental things and you use this device to get everybody on board, sort of, like, hey, let's all get together on this notion, because of the way I'm saying this, that this is an outrageous expectation. You can kind of spin that as if people are asking, I think what he says, asking for the moon, because what are we talking about? We're talking about habitable space, which in this climate means that sometimes, yeah, you do have to have, especially if you're in a tiny house or something, you do have to have some AC. You do have to, you do have to have some heating. You do need running water, a place to prepare food and store food and take showers. Keeping your laundry reasonably clean. These things all require resources. They all require that the city step up to the plate. And if we're going to do shelter, yes, all of those things are necessary. So to spin it as if it's an outrageous demand is really a propaganda kind of device. It doesn't have anything to do with the reality of what any one of us would think was humane treatment for people who are indigent. Of course you need these things.
Well, Patrick, just to expand on what we hear Morgan say in that interview, he says, quote, "These are strange things for people that don't contribute to society at all to demand." So so Sean Morgan is characterizing the unhoused, the poorest among us, as, quote, "people that don't contribute to society at all." I'm wondering, I mean, Pat, you're out in the streets. I've been with you out on the streets. We have a lot of veterans out on the streets. I guess those veterans who served in the military. Did Sean Morgan serve in the military? But I don't think he did.
Not to my knowledge.
No, but so we have these vets who are brain damaged and PTSD'd. I guess they've done nothing at all to contribute to society. Right, we have parents who are homeless. We've been out on the plaza. I've seen parents with kids out on the plaza. They've done nothing to contribute. So first of all, that's one thing that Morgan tells us, that and he refers to them elsewhere in the interview as the vagrant community. Yeah, Pat, what? Give me some.
Listen to the life history of many, many people on the street. They've contributed a lot. But what happens to the guy that's in the carpenters union? And I'm thinking of a particular case, and he's been, you know, pounding nails for 20 years, and then a rack of pipes fall on his head, and one other brain injury happens to him, and he's now has no net under him, so he falls onto the streets, and is that a person who's never contributed? No. But what it is at this point is a person who has a disability. And one of the things that also happens on the right, in addition to the fact that they're denying that there's a housing deficit, there's housing deprivation going on, is there's a denial of disability going on here too. These two things hold hands, because when you put the two together, you have this nasty little intersection here where you're going, look, there's no housing crisis and there's no such thing as a disability. So again, if I go back to this question of, well, what's going on with housing as the fundamental problem, affordable housing at the core of all of this, if you don't have enough housing units, what happens, I've said this many, many times, is there's a competition for the housing units that do exist. Who's going to win? Well, it's not going to be the person with the brain injury who's indigent. It's not going to be the person with the mental illness who's indigent. It's not going to be the person with addiction issues. It's not going to be the person who's been in 30 foster homes and is dealing with PTSD. It's not going to be that veteran if he can't jump through the hoops in a program. So this, the kind of person who is out there, you can label them as unproductive, but if you look at who they are and how they get sorted into this category of being homeless, that has to do with the competition that goes on for a resource that's limited. And the losers in that competition are people who don't effectively market themselves, who cannot win the competition against somebody like me, who has more resources and can go out and figure out a way with higher credits, goals, and stuff, to get a rental if I need one. So the conversation here is so far removed from an honest rendition of what's happening with these people. If you look at the resource and then you look at them person by person and you look at how they can or cannot plug in, bringing up the fact that they're not stockbrokers is really pretty far afield from what we're talking about in terms of the reality of why these people aren't housed.
The voice of Patrick Newman here today on the Peace and Social Justice Program. We're deconstructing in this segment Sean Morgan's comments, for which he was reprimanded by the court as a violation of breach in confidentiality. Pat, we'll take just a quick break. On the other side of this little break, I want to just finish up with the Sean Morgan side. And I want to move on to what happened at the city council. Pat, you had the fortune, the misfortune, to have to spend time in the city council last night, heroically standing up to a lot of this sort of hatred that comes, the anti-homeless hatred. And I want to talk about a couple of things after we finish with the Sean Morgan thing, and that is the ice skating rink that's happening here in Chico, and then the question of the Hope Street, the report of Hope Street. So we'll do all that on the other side of this little break and be back in just a moment. Hang in there. Should have known. It's hard to understand. There was love in this man. I'm sure all would agree that his misery was this woman and things. Now Fred is dead. That's what I say.
Tune in to the North State Water Report with me, Ron Tobey, on the fifth Thursday of each month at 7 p.m., where we talk about regional water issues and how our water usage and state and county water policy affects the natural hydrological cycle. Tune in on the fifth Thursday of each month at 7 p.m., the North State Water Report.
Peace and Social Justice Program. Pat, let's finish up our little segment here on the analysis, if you will, of the Sean Morgan. Let's go to the last segment that I wanted to bring up. It's a little two-minute segment in which he lays out what he sees as where the city is going from here. So let's listen to that one.
But here's what I'm optimistic about. Here's what we're going to do. The airport's costing us $35,000 a month. The hostage holders didn't budge. They didn't move. So why leave that there? Why continue to give that to them? There's no benefit. We have no benefit. So we're going to shut it down. We're going to take the resources there. We're going to put them in Comanche Creek, not to make the plaintiffs happy, because they're never going to be happy, but to protect the business owners that are surrounded there down on Meyer Street. We're going to move the fencing down there. We're going to move the dumpsters. We'll move the porta potties. We'll do everything we can to make it as good for those business owners that contribute to society as good as we can, while we race to get that number, that bed number, 571. We don't have to build 571 because there's a bunch of stuff already online. Most likely at the BMX track. We've looked at buying buildings, throwing a whole bunch of beds in there. But because of COVID, there's kind of this anti-conjugate living thing. Because that'd be the easiest thing to do. Go rent a building, put 300 beds in it, whatever it is we need, call it good. But we've been... It's been indicated that probably won't do it, because that's not really what the plaintiffs want. So again, we are negotiating. The other side has the judge and a gun to our head, and we got to do all we can to protect our citizens and our parks. We are going to race to get to it. Here's the other downside: the BMXers, the bike riders that we pledged years to, is like, hey, if we move you, we're going to help you move. We're going to do all these things. They are probably going to be told, you guys got to get out of here pretty fast. We feel bad for your industry. We feel bad for the kids. But this is not the city. The city's going to get blamed for this. Oh, the city, they're moving out these kids, and these kids just want to ride their bikes. Yes, this is not the city doing this. This is those eight people. These are those plaintiffs. They have all the control, because the Boise Martin case is written terribly. And when they're done with Chico, they'll move on to another city and another city and another city until this goes all the way to the Supreme Court.
Patrick Newman, thoughts on the council member, the pontificate, the ruminations of the intellect of Sean Morgan. What do you have to say about that?
I just find this kind of slapdash language when we're talking about human beings really interesting here. We could throw a bunch of beds in a big building and get that thing done, throw 300 cots, and, you know, it's kind of into an airport hangar and maybe throw some AC. I mean, and who would we be doing this for? We'd be doing it for people who are, in his view, unworthy of anything. And so that's pretty disheartening. It sounds like we're talking about a subhuman class of people who deserve absolutely nothing and really shouldn't exist. And I think, honestly, where this resonates is with, I don't know, it really sounds genocidal to me. That's really honestly what it sounds like to me. It sounds like somebody who has so little regard for these people that absolutely nothing should be done to address their needs. And that when you do that, ultimately where that leads to, the logical conclusion of that is that when you do absolutely nothing, people starve to death, they die. We've done this before with people. I don't know. I hate to say it because, in a way, because it's sort of like pushing into the future in terms of like how I see this conversation unfolding, but watching it for 8 years kind of closely. I think there's some of these authoritarian strains in here that scare me. They make me think about a lot, you know, a number of historical episodes where this kind of thinking led to really horrendous crimes against humanity. So that's what I get out of it, and maybe that's an exaggeration, but that's sort of what I hear in that voice that says, let's just, you know, throw a bunch of cots somewhere, let's put a chain link fence around that place. And doesn't talk about meeting any needs inside that fence. All he talks about is the people who are outside the fence being protected from the people inside the fence, because those subhumans inside the fence can't possibly be worthy of anything better. I don't know. What did you get?
Yeah, well, no, Patrick, look, there's no sense of care for the individuals, care for the families, care for the brain injured, because this is not about care. This is about demonizing. This is about ghettoizing, right? Creating a ghetto. We're talking about the history of authoritarian oppression. You know, put people in an area, put a fence around the area, maybe put little gold stars on their clothes. I mean, there is precedence for this kind of talk. I don't think you're exaggerating when you say this is a kind of a neo-authoritarian. It's very dangerous. Very dangerous talk.
Well, and just rolling back to what, when you read Judge England's description of shelter, there's nothing in that description that Auschwitz fits that description.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
every element there.
Yeah.
So this is something that should bring more critical analysis for people, because more critical thinking, because We haven't gotten to the point where we really see this as a human right as a society. We're really not at that point. Even with Martin V. Boyce does not carve that out for us. So we have challenges here that we're really working our way through. What scares me is that there's, you know, some political winds that seem to be blowing toward what I think of as totalitarian solutions to this, and if things get very much worse, I'm not sure where this goes. I think people ought to be alarmed.
I'm speaking with Patrick Newman, the founder of Chico Friends on the Street, a human rights and homeless advocacy organization here in Chico at ChicoFriendsOnTheStreet.org. Well, Pat, now I want to touch on a couple things, Pat, before we run out of time on the program.
Before we do, though, I just want to close out the Morgan.
Yeah.
Interview chapter here with how it ended. And I'll read one paragraph from the end of a story in the Enterprise Record.
In a response filed Monday by Newman, the order to show cause, that was the magistrate, Judge Newman, the order to show cause was discharged, seemingly agreeing with the city attorney that Morgan did not intend to reveal confidential information. I kind of wanted to bring that up because when did not intending to break a law serve as a defense? I don't, in my life experience, that's not something I'm particularly I'm aware of. When I go through a red light, can I say to the police officer, I did not intend to go through that red light? Well, there's a whole lot of ground that could cover. Not intending to break confidentiality as a defense, which was the only defense the city offered, it worked, I guess, in terms of, you know, no fine, no consequence, essentially. But you're responsible in terms of the public trust here. And intention, to me, seems like a rather weak defense. And I just have to say that breaks new ground in my understanding of how the law works. And it seems to me that given that the right wing is insistent that people follow laws and the rule of law and all that kind of stuff to the letter, If you're going to be consistent on that, then you can't bring up intention as a defense. Intention is simply a state of mind as you commit a crime, and that's never been a legal defense in my life experience. Anyway, I just wanted to add that part.
Thanks, that's good to clarify.
Interesting closure to this.
How it ended up. It's not that the city had to pay a fine. It's that Sean Morgan said, I didn't really mean to do this, and I'll never do it again. I think I used to give that same kind of defense when my mom caught me with my hand in the cookie jar. I used to say, well, I didn't mean to eat the cookies. I'll never do it again.
And not only that, but there's 15 minutes of, you know, propaganda and cheerleading that's been embraced and effective on that. Let's just say what John Morgan always says on that side, that's, you know, for which there's no consequence. And it's really not a fair in a negotiation to have one side being able to breach confidentiality and the other not. Wouldn't it be nice if the judge had given legal services 15 minutes to give their spin on what's happening inside that black box so that they could inform the community on their point of view? Well, we're not going to see that.
Well, anyway, I mean, look, and one last thing on that. I mean, we get haranguing, we get beating the drum on the right, that's responsibility, you got to take responsibility, the homeless, right? Here's Sean Morgan, his big moment in the Sun, he could take responsibility and said, I made a mistake, the fine is legitimate, I shouldn't be but no, when the right, and in this case when folks like Sean Morgan, when they say we must each take responsibility for our actions and law and order and suffer the consequences, that only applies when it's not me. When it's me, then I massage the system. I didn't mean to. I'm sorry. Right. So.
And how many homeless people intended, mm-hmm. you know, to be homeless when they were, you know, 2 years old? Look at the life history of these people. So they're breaking all these laws that were put on the books by Sean Morgan, which are impossible not to break if you're homeless because you don't have a right to sleep. You don't have a right to set up a tent anywhere. I mean, you go down this list of things. You don't have access to 24-hour toilets, you know, et cetera. All this stuff. Okay. Did anybody intend to break all of these laws that, you know, Rob Berry and John Morgan and these and many others are insisting that they not break? Well, what's intention mean? It's
before we get back into that, I need to let people know that peace and social justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Cotton Party. Cotton Party offering contemporary women's clothing and accessories with an emphasis on natural fibers. Cotton Party has been providing friendly service for over 30 years in the heart of downtown Chico at 337 Broadway Street. Cotton Party is grateful for your business and offers complimentary gift wrapping with each purchase. More information by calling Cotton Party at 893-4923. Lastly, peace and social justice is made possible by Square Deal Mattress Factory, building the best night's sleep since 1920. Square Deal is celebrating over 100 years of making mattresses, bedding, furniture, and now face masks with the fabric of your choice right here in Chico, California. Square Deal is located at 1354 Humboldt Avenue. For details, see squaredealmattress.com. You went to the city council meeting last night. My understanding is that the city council voted to green light the ice skating rink there in the city plaza. Let's see. The city plaza happens to be a place where homeless poor folk congregate. So we all know that this has nothing at all to do with displacing homeless. It's just a wonderful, a beautiful, rousing holiday. A change for the holidays. So, Pat, give us a little update on the ice skating rink at the city council last night. I heard recently this week on Wednesday, I heard our colleague here at the station, Steve O'Brien, saying that the day after the city council, Wednesday morning, he saw the PG&E guys, you know, putting in this infrastructure there, working on the providing the electricity and such for the ice skating rink. So I find it interesting that the council meeting ended on Tuesday evening, and then Wednesday morning they're out there. So sometimes when I call PG&E, it takes a while, but apparently when you're putting in an ice skating rink in the plaza where homeless people live, it's amazing how fast we get our men and women working with PG&E. They get on the job really quick. So looks like we have about 10 minutes, but let's see if we can unpack these major. We got the ice skating rink, and we got the
Paul Webster.
Paul Webster
Hope Street.
Give us a 10-minute synopsis of what the hell's going on over there.
So the ice skating rink, get through that, and we can probably talk about that pretty quickly. The battle for the public space, and there's books written on this, has been going on probably since the beginning of civilization. And we have in the center of Chico the plaza, and that's a public space that, it's being battled over. And there's a lot of ways that battle has, unfolded over the years that I've been down there. And it's where I started, actually, when the Orchard Church was kicked off that space. So there was this battle going on way back in 2013 when I first got going. Okay, so what's going on with that public space? The plaza is at the core of the community geographically. It has a lot of symbolic value. And it's also where a lot of people who have ended up on the streets, who are shelter deprived, spend time. And they use the restroom there, and they kind of hang out there, and they socialize there. Why? Well, because if you're homeless, these public spaces become your bathroom, your kitchen, your living room, and your bedroom. That's what happens in the public space when you dump 500,000 people onto the streets. So the plaza, from the point of view of homeless human rights and the suffering of that class of people, it's a resource that people on the streets utilize for many things. Okay, so from my perverse, bizarre perspective, I see that as a legitimate use of that public space. And there's people sleeping there now because of the injunction. I also see that as a legitimate use of that space, given that we have a crisis. One of the ways that we can cleanse that space is by bringing in activities that push the homeless out. We can put a fence around it for weeks at a time, which has been done in the last year, and pretend that we're making repairs when weeks go by and no one's in there repairing anything. And we can, in this case, do a two-month ice skating rink service to the community that's going to essentially take that entire space away from people who are on the streets. In terms of priorities, there's environmental objections to doing this, but to me, the core objection is that having spent a lot of time in that space and now some part of Sunday, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I'm in that space, and now for thousands of hours, over more than 5 years, and another time earlier, I've gotten to know people in that space, how they exist in that space, who they are. Their humanity is something that I have connected with. So dropping this ice skating rink on top of it for the benefit of the really the wealthiest people in Chico, because there's going to be costs for using the ice skating rink, renting skates, renting helmets, hot chocolate, whatever else is going to be. We're talking about a class of people that can spend $100 on a family outing easily, maybe $100 plus. And so we're to meet their needs. We're gonna drop this thing into the plaza. And from my perspective, it's at the expense of the use of the plaza in a more porous way for people who really need it, who are out there on the streets. Okay, so last night at the city council, I did speak against it, the ice skating rink, on that basis. I was the only person who did. I think that position is seen as, I don't know, eccentric, bizarre. But yet, if I look at human rights principles, mm-hmm. it seems pretty obvious to me that an ice skating rink does not take precedence.
Well, you're such a killjoy for pointing out the fact that the ice skating rink, which is basically a playground for, you know, relatively affluent folk compared to the unhoused, you're a killjoy for pointing out that that will be displacing and really upturning the lives of quite a number of people who spend most of their time in the plaza. And I think that it's actually a cynical move on the part of the city to, under the cover of a ice skating rink, to implement this program. And again, it's there's no care. We talked earlier, the care for individuals, the care for these people's lives, that is, it's not even considered. So it's really a cynical, I think it's a cynical move to have some kind of festive holiday, rink. It's under the, you know, under the guise of holiday festivity, when in fact it is the implementation of an authoritarian displacement of the poorest of our fellow citizens in Chico.
Well, and last night I in my comments I said that this is a deliberate attempt to take that space back from the people who tend to be there. And that was, of course, Sean Morgan made a point of saying that that was a fraud. And I was out of order on the next comment I made, because I wasn't on the subject that I was supposed to be on. But I said to Sean Morgan, why don't you spend a couple hundred hours in that space with those people and get to know them, and then tell me that it's a fraud, because I think you'd see it a little differently. But that's one of the huge problems we have, is that very few of these people, and people in general, spend enough time getting to know the population to have any kind of affection for them, or any knowledge of who they are, or any empathy or connect, you know. So, yeah. So then we do these crazy things, and it meets the needs of people with houses. But, you know, Canyon Oaks, you drive down here in your SUV and you take your, you know, okay. Anyway, so then one of the later items of the
we're down to our last 5 minutes. I know it's really tough to squeeze these kinds of things in, but let's see if we can do some justice in our final 5 minutes to the last item that was on our docket, which was the Paul Webster.
Sure. So Paul Webster and he has an organization called Hope Street. Very little information about this organization. It's very new. I think it's less than a year old, actually. Paul Webster has a history in HUD during the Trump administration. He's part of a contingent of people who see the homeless problem as not a housing problem, but really it's like a behavior problem. So he makes a point out of saying we don't give people free housing, and makes a point out of driving toward eliminating what he thinks of, I think, as sort of extravagant civil liberties that prevent just arresting people who are drug addicted or mentally ill and putting them in facilities. So this is really where he's going with his thinking. He's been hired by the city of Chico to the tune of $50,000 to come in and do reports about Chico based on his knowledge of federal and state law, and how federal and state law has made it difficult for municipalities to deal with this problem. So that's his area of expertise. So his report, which sort of got dropped into the agenda, it seems to me, late. But anyway, there was a chance for a few of us to speak on it, And all four who spoke on it talked about it, the flaws in Webster's entire approach. Of course, that's going to fall on deaf ears. But the main flaw in Webster's approach is that, at least as you see in this report, is that he doesn't take anything that he critiques in terms of governmental responses to these problems and develop a report that involves an in-depth analysis of why the government has arrived at certain conclusions, like under Lanterman, why are there restrictions on taking people's liberty who are mentally ill? What's the history of that? Where did that come from back in the 70s when we made these civil rights strides for people who are mentally ill? Instead, he puts together, he cherry-picks things out of the state and federal and state law and programs, and then critiques them from the point of view of someone who sees these as obstacles to doing what I was saying, which is really to get people off the street by coercing them into programs. I would guess woefully underfunded programs. And so that approach is not the approach that I would think you would see with someone who's providing objective analysis. And I stated last night at the council meeting that this is an opinion piece that he's created. It's a 7-page opinion piece. It's not a study that helps you understand the broad implications of all these things, where they came from. So it would take a while to go through that 7 pages and really look at all the elements of it. But what we see is an anti-government, authoritarian approach anti-government in the sense that there's good government that can provide for the common welfare if we want to step up to the plate, that kind of government, and then really a defense of authoritarian measures to get people off the streets that have nothing to do with creating more housing. He doesn't talk about housing at all. In fact, he says flat out, no free housing. So we're not going to provide housing. We're not going to give people services that they might, you know, need under a Lloyd Pendleton housing first model. We're going to use this authoritarian model to get all the addicts and the mentally ill into containment facilities, and that's going to solve our homeless problem.
And, Pat, as you've said many times, these are the kinds of actions that anyone who is a advocate for human rights, for civil liberties, should be concerned about this. And so I think this is the kind of thing we need to get people behind. It's not the kind of thing that's super popular, but this is slowly the encroachment into civil liberties, the encroachment into human rights. It happens so slow, you know, that you might not notice, but we're part of what we're doing here on the program today is to send the signal flare up to folks and say, hey, this is happening in our city. And so anyway, well, look, we've run out of time. We hit the end of the hour, and I want to thank you as usual. Thank you for your heroic work here in the community on behalf of the most demonized population here in Chico, the most impoverished, materially impoverished folks, certainly not spiritually or humanity-wise. You do some great work. If people want to reach you, they can email you at chicofriendsonthestreet@gmail.com. Is that right?
That's a great way to get a hold of me, or you can message me on Facebook, or just show up on the City Plaza. I'm not there every single time now. I've tried to back off on Sunday a bit, but I tend to be there Monday and Friday a lot. But if you want to just show up and be a part of these gatherings, Sunday at noon, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 9 o'clock. Right now we're on the southeast corner of the plaza where we've been for years. And I think it's a good introduction to really meeting people on the street and demonstrating some solidarity with them and some support for their right to exist.
Well, Patrick Newman, thanks again. Thanks for your time out on the street. I just got hit with this idea. Just we can bounce it back and forth, you and I, after we get off the air. But maybe what we can do is have donations of ice skates to home. We could have imagine if we had 50 homeless folk ice skating. It might really that might be the way to go on this.
Yeah, I wonder how much tickets are going to cost to get them inside there.
We'll get them in. We'll get them the skates. We'll get them in, and then the city can enjoy. Anyway, Patrick Newman, again, it's been a pleasure. Wonderful to have you on the program. Thanks for all the work you're doing on behalf of our most impoverished, materially impoverished community. You have been listening to the Peace and Social Justice program. Stay tuned for Playing Dead at 1 to 3, and then 3 o'clock, Devastation Sounds goes till 6. Keep it tuned in right here to KZFR, online at kzfr.org. Until next week, take care, be kind, take good care of yourself. See you later. Bye-bye.
Hey listeners, it's time for the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar with me, Megan Hammer. Soul of California, an evening of live music, will be held on Saturday, September 25th from 2 p.m. to 10 p.m. This event is being put on by Sunset River Resort, and all proceeds from the concert will go to support those displaced by the North Complex and Dixie wildfires. Taking place on the banks of the Feather, Soul of California is the first of a series of live music concerts and events. Tickets are $15 each. Children under 16 are free. Tickets can be found via Eventbrite. And for event and ticket information, you can call 530-521-2081. If you have an event you'd like on the community calendar, let me know by sending us an email at cc@kzfr.org. This is the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar.
All righty, and it is 1 o'clock, straight up on the money. My name is Ray Lager. I'll be your host today on Playing Dead, Music of the Grateful Dead, every Friday afternoon from 1 to 3. And it's kind of a farewell summer show, so we're going to go back to Red Rocks for a beautiful show on 7778.